This is Larry Jones. You are listening to the Grace and Glory Hour of the Dyer Baptist Church with our co-pastors, David M. Atkinson and Dr. Lee Atkinson. We are coming to you from Dyer, Indiana. Our prayer is that you will be strengthened by the word today. Now, here is our pastor.
Gazing on the face of our shepherd changes everything, doesn't it? What you focus on, what you're looking at, makes all the difference in the world. And how appropriate for our series that we're in, loving God and loving your neighbor. Perhaps you have, perhaps you haven't taken time to read and consider the placards at the front of the auditorium. One says, love God, and then, interestingly, has something familiar. Yes, some of the Ten Commandments on it. Kind of mixing Old and New Testament. And the other placard says, love your neighbor as yourself, and also has some of the Ten Commandments. And we hope to get into some of that this morning. As we consider this series, and hopefully for much of the year, loving God and loving our neighbor, isn't it good of God to take all of life and boil it down to two simple things that you can hang your hat on? That there's not a lot of mystery and question about what God expects from us. It's not complicated. It's not always easy. But it's very simple. The teacher, the lawyer, the Pharisee came to Jesus and said, what are the most important things? And he said, love God and love your neighbor. We saw recently that these are the two most important rules for life. Please, please hang on to this for the rest of your life. You can succeed at a lot of things, but if you fail at these two commands, your life has failed. You can fail at a lot of things. You cannot be good at this or not be good at that, but if you follow these principles, you've got a good life. We saw also that these two commandments, these two principles, are intertwined inextricably. The Bible teaches that you can't love God without loving your neighbor. There's a relationship there. And you're not right with God if you're not right with your neighbor. And sometimes you think, oh, well, I've got a bad roommate, and I've got a bad spouse, and I've got bad neighbors, and I've got bad coworkers. Man, it's amazing how there's so many bad people in the world, and they're all in my life, but it's a good thing I'm right with God. And we chuckle, because when it's said out loud, it does sound ridiculous. But when it's in here, it's very believable. It's all their fault. These principles are intertwined inextricably. And then thirdly, we saw that these two things, loving God and loving our neighbor, are dependent on God's love for us. We couldn't love him if he hadn't loved us first. And we couldn't love others if God hadn't loved us and showed us how to love. I think sometimes we have some misconceptions about God's love for us, which is the foundation for all of this. I certainly have sometimes, in my own mind, conceived of God's love as something that's primarily a doctrinal creed. You know, God is a loving God. He's not like Zeus, and that's as far as I went, you know. He's not, you know, going to lighten me or whatever. He's a loving God because that's what the Bible says, and that's the true fact about him. And when we do that, we sell God short. It's really an insult. And so three things we consider about God's love for us is, first of all, that his love, it is greater than any of our circumstances. Look, there's people that I love that circumstances keep me from doing anything for them right now. I got a message this morning, kind of between Sunday school and church, about somebody that's going through something really tough right now, and there isn't a thing in the world I can do about it. But God's love is not like that. God's love is greater than our circumstances. It is everlasting love. It is love that nothing can separate us from. We saw also that God's love is deeper, it is more real, it is more genuinely lovey, if I could say it that way, than the human love you have experienced from anyone in the world. Think of it, whether it's the love that your mother had for you or the love that you have for your child. Maybe you're really close to your brother. Maybe it's someone you served in the military with. But somebody that you just have this really, really amazing bond with. Can I tell you that that is pale and cool compared to God's love for you? Again, we think that God's love is just kind of, well, it's technical. He has to. You know, he's omniscient because if he weren't omniscient, he wouldn't be God. And he loves me because if he didn't love me, he wouldn't be God. No, it's so much more than that. God says, look, you are evil, selfish people, and yet you love to give food to your children. How much more am I, as a good God, going to love to give good gifts to you? He truly loves you more than anybody else. With passion. With feeling. Don't think of God as an unemotional being. Just because he's holy doesn't mean he has no emotion. Where do you think we got our emotion from? An unemotional God is going to create emotional people? He has no capacity, and yet we do? We are in some capacity greater than God? I think not. In fact, if we have a capacity for something, God's capacity is greater. If we have a capacity to know, his capacity to know is greater. If we have a capacity to serve, his capacity is greater. If we have a capacity to love, his capacity is deeper, broader, richer, stronger than any kind of capacity like that we have for love. And so he tells us that. He says, look, a mother with a nursing child might forget about her baby, but I'm not going to forget about you. It says in one of the minor prophets, Zephaniah, how he rejoices over us with singing. You know, love sings, don't you? There's a whole multi-billion dollar industry built on love songs, right? Most of them really aren't love songs. They're lust songs, probably, right? But love sings. And God sings over you. He cares deeply about you. It's warm and personal, the feeling that he has for you. God's love for his people is more positive than negative. It's not just that God says, well, I guess I won't send them to hell. No, Jesus says, I want you to be with me where I am. Do you see the vast difference between those two things? Okay, well, technically, Jesus shed his blood, and since they believed and called upon him, I have to let them out of hell. No, Jesus literally is dying to get you to be with him. Because he loves you, and it's a positive love, not just some kind of a negative love. Well, I'd like us now to kind of begin into this perspective of comparing the Ten Commandments to God's one command to love him. Jesus said, on these two commands hang or depend all the law and the prophets. In other words, you can think of love God and love your neighbor as the Roman numerals, okay? And the Ten Commandments are the capital letter A, capital letter B. They are subpoints that are sustained by the main point. So the big idea God has for us is, I want you to love me. And then in his commands, in the law, and in the prophets, he kind of breaks that down for us a little bit and says, this is what that's going to look like. This is how I want you to love me. This is how it's going to work. This is what I would like you to do. Sometimes I think we read the Ten Commandments or the laws of Deuteronomy or something as if we were reading, like, I don't know, the town code. What's the point? Or maybe it's the rule book or the safety manual at your job, or maybe it's the rules at your school. Or maybe it's the instructions of your automobile. Like, man, what's the point of all these rules? Rules, rules, rules. It's like somebody up there just likes making rules for the sake of rules. And I think if we're honest, sometimes we've read God's laws as if it's like an arbitrary code. Let me make some things they can do and some things they can't do. And if they do the wrong things, bam, they get in trouble. That's totally selling short God, and it's selling short his law. His law is not some arbitrary code by which he's going to either find us guilty or innocent. Remember, it hangs on the principle, love me. And so his commands, including the Ten Commandments, drive us to that point, and they illustrate that point of what it is to love God. We'll try to see briefly how the first four commandments really are just ways that say, love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and all your strength. So let's turn to Exodus chapter 20 and review these verses and ask ourselves, what is God saying in these commandments that support the idea that I should love him? What is God saying in these first four commandments that are really just another way of saying, love me? Exodus 20. And God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. In passing, I think it would be good for us to observe that the grounds for these commandments that God is about to give. In other words, I thought about titling the message this way. I command you to love me. That kind of sounds odd, doesn't it? Guys, when you go home today, those of you that are married, I don't suggest that that's the first thing you say when you see your wife each day. I command thee to love me. Not a good idea. But God essentially says that. He says the greatest commandment is for you to love me. I command you to love me. What right does he have to say that? And these four commandments, thou shalt have no other gods before me, thou shalt not make thee any graven image. What right does he have to say, you need to do this and not do that as a way of demonstrating your love to me because you need to love me? Well, in the first two verses here, there's an indication of why God is commanding us to love him. He says, I am the Lord thy God. Notice, first of all, there's a relationship there, isn't he? He says, I'm your God. We have this relationship. And then he says, which have brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. He said, I've done something for you. I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine. And so because I'm your God and you're my people, because we have relationship, and because I have delivered you from Egypt, you should love me. And this is what it will look like. There's probably, I think, one of the most potent parables on God's love for his people in, of all places, the prophets. In Ezekiel chapter 16, God, through his man, gives some of the most profound, picturesque, and in some places graphic descriptions of his love for us. I will very briefly summarize the chapter for you. God says of his people, he says, you were like a newborn baby that nobody wanted. You know, I think today is Sanctity of Human Life Sunday, isn't it? And we all know the tragedy that sometimes babies and baby parts are found in dumpsters. Not just in the United States, but here as well. An unwanted newborn baby. What a tragic thing. And because of man's sinfulness, that's not anything new. And so God could describe that scene to his people and say, people, you were like that unwanted baby. You weren't killed and put in a dumpster. You were just left on the side of the road to die slowly by yourself. He said, you hadn't even been washed from the birth process. No one had taken care of your umbilical cord. You were struggling, weak. You were lying, frankly, in a pool of your own blood. And God says, I came by and I saw you. And I picked you up. And I cleaned you. And I swaddled you. And I took you to my home. And I took care of you. And I fed you. And I didn't just feed you. I gave you really good food. I gave you beautiful clothes. And as you grew up, I gave you jewelry. And you have become a beautiful young woman. And the way you have responded to what I did for you is to go out and be immoral at every opportunity. He said, not only you weren't hiring yourself out because you needed money to feed yourself. In fact, you took the gifts that I gave to you and you gave them to people so that they would be immoral with you. How could you do this to me? I did everything for you. I saved you from certain death. I showered my love on you and I demonstrate it with all kinds of care and provision. And you walk out of me. God says, I'm not asking much, but I'm asking you to love me. That is spoken initially, especially of the nation of Israel. And if we think of the treachery of Israel and her backsliding sister Judah, and think how awful that they could do that to Jehovah, who brought them up out of the land of Egypt. Is it not true that all of us, individually and collectively, have done as bad or worse? God created us. He gave us life. And we said, no, I will be my own thing. We've taken the gifts that he's given us and we've used them for our own ends and purposes, almost to the point that we wanted to use his gifts to us so that people would worship us. That's what pride is. Anytime we brag, and oh, we do it so often, we have a way of twisting our conversations so that we always come out looking good. It's taking God's gifts and using them to get people to worship us, which is idolatry. We are no better than the woman in the parable of Ezekiel 16. And God says, love me. Love me. I am thy God. I'm yours. Think of the other prophet who said, I've seen two evils. Not only have you forsaken me, the true and living God, you've hewn out for yourself broken cisterns which hold no water. You've abandoned the one thing that's good and you've embraced lots of things that aren't any good. He says, remember, I'm your God. And remember, I brought you out of Egypt. I love you, and that's why you should love me. And if you love me, this is how it'll go. Verse 3. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. The first way that we see the Ten Commandments showing us that it's all about loving God with all our heart and soul, God says, I want you to love me most. How's that for simple? I want you to love me most. Simple, short words, very easy to comprehend. But do we? Too often we don't. He says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. We are to have no loyalty or admiration higher than him. God is a jealous God. We'll see a little bit later in the chapter. If you love someone, you want them to reciprocate in love and not love someone else more than you. Right? Okay, and so a lot of times in Scripture, it uses the picture of a marriage relationship and even a parent-child relationship. So parents, how do you feel when your children go to their grandparents or their aunt and uncle, and their aunt and uncle or their grandparents, they buy them all kinds of fun stuff and let them do whatever they want to, and they come back home and they say, you know, Uncle Richie, he's the best. And what am I, chopped liver? Go let Uncle Richie start buying your clothes for you and washing your underwear. How about that? We'll let Uncle Richie start getting up in the morning to take you to school. If Uncle Richie's so great, how come Uncle... Right? We get a little jealous. Because like, hey, Uncle Richie's great, and I'm sure he loves you. But he don't love you like I love you. Right? And if we can be jealous like that, how much more right does God the Father have to say, you better not have any gods before me. And I'm raising my voice and I'm pointing at you, but I want you to understand, God loves you so much. We ought to be happy to love him back. You know, this is a good thing. When we see the greatness of his love that is deeper than what anyone else has for us, how could we but just love him back? He says, I don't want any rivals. I want you to love me most. Sometimes money is a rival, or maybe our own children. Sometimes pleasure or possessions. But I think probably the idol that is most consistently attacking God's place in our life is probably my own self. Most often, it's Lee Atkinson that I worship the most. I want to put him on God's chair. I want the world to revolve around his preferences, his desires, his goals, his schedules, his likes, and his dislikes. And if things don't go my way, I'm upset. As if my way matters. As if my way is right. As if I know anything. God is in heaven. I am a man. I am on earth. I better just be quiet. God is God. Don't worship yourself. Don't think it's about you. Don't allow your desires to determine the decisions you make. Jesus said it this way in Luke chapter 9. If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Denying yourself is an act of worship. Think about that. I don't know about you. I don't like to deny myself. Somebody says something that makes me look bad and I want to set the record straight to make myself look good. What do you need to do? Deny yourself. Say, you know what? I don't have to come out looking good. God can look good. Somebody hurts your feelings and you want to give them equal back? You don't have to. It's about God. Just deny yourself. And my wife has said this so many times at home. We've had this great discussion. She said, anything that makes me deny myself is good for me. Whew, that stinks. It means anytime I don't get my way, it's good for me. So I've made it my ministry to make sure she has to deny herself a lot. I just serve it like that way. I hope I'm kidding. But isn't it true? When things go bad at work and you have to deny yourself, that's a good thing. When traffic is bad and you have to deny yourself, that's a good thing. When the job gets harder than you expect it to be, that's a good thing. On and on we could go. Why? Because what we're doing is we're saying, self, get out of that throne. Don't do what you want to do. Do what God said to do. God says it's good to make an oath and keep it even when it's hard to keep it. So I said I'm going to do that. It's harder than I thought. I'm still going to do it because God said so. I'm not on the throne. Whatever situation comes your way, I'm not on the throne. God is. Deny yourself. You know, and sometimes we associate denying yourself and taking up your cross with like being a missionary to Bangladesh or something like that. There's certainly that involved. But can I say that Luke 9, I think it's verse 23, says, let every man take up his cross. You don't have to take up Miss Johnson's cross. You gotta take up yours. Your cross may be a drafty house, and instead of complaining about it, you're going to thank God for it. Your cross may be a car that's older than the one you want. Your cross may be a difficult relationship right now. Take it up. Get off the throne and worship God. God says in his first commandment, how do you love me more than anything else? Just prefer me to others. I think it's illustrated well in the wedding vows that some say, forsaking all others, keep you only unto him. Do you do that for God? Have you forsaken all others? I hope so. Second commandment is similar to the first commandment, but it is different. Let's look at it. It's verses 4 through 6. Exodus 20, 4 through 6. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me. There it is, love me. And keep my commandments. Commandment number two. This series isn't meant to totally dissect everything in the commandment, but it's not a strict prohibition of any kind of representation through art form. Because God, in other places, would command artisans to make things that looked like certain other things. The term image, or graven image, or likeness, often, if not most of the time in Scripture, is referenced to what in the day, in the original culture, they understood to be something for worship. An idol. And he says, don't make anything graven as part of your religious worship practice. Don't use a carving. Don't use something that you build or sketch to be a prop or a part of your worship of me. And so in his second commandment, I think we can see that among other things, God is saying, love me more than anything. Love me as I am. Love me as I am. Why is it so important that we don't make a physical representation of God to worship God? Because it's not Him. Because we can never capture Him in any kind of art form that we know. It will always fall woefully short. And being the creatures that tend to walk by sight rather than by faith, we're going to tend to associate our concept of God with the thing more than with the idea of who God's person really is. And God knows that. And so he says, don't make anything that you hold on to while you pray or you look at while you bow, because you're going to start to think that thing is God and not me.
That's true.
And I don't want your focus to be on that thing. I want your focus to be on me. I want you to love me as I am, not how you've constructed me to be.
Yes.
Somebody said, God made man in his own image, and ever since, man has been trying to redo the favor. Trying to make God in our image. He's not. And if it's wrong to make a physical image of God to worship, it's also wrong for us to mentally conceive of God as different than he is and worship that. It could be accidental, it could be deliberate, it is nevertheless wrong. We are to love God enough to worship him in purity, not in a deluded way that is more appealing to us, but demeaning to him. Okay, time's getting on, so let me say that again. We are to love God enough to worship him in purity, not in a diluted way that's more appealing to us, but demeaning to him. In other words, any idol I construct, mentally or physically, to help me worship God is demeaning to him. It's an insult to him. But I like it, because I can attain unto it, and I can understand it, and I can appreciate it, and I can see it, and it suits me better. That's not okay. Picture it this way. What if, I've already, talked about my idol once, so let me just sit here. What if I go down to the basement this afternoon where the kids' Lego collection is, most of it, and I start sorting through there, and I see some pieces, and I put them together, and I'm such a bad artist. I mean, I don't draw stick men well at all, and I'm not much better with Lego. And let's say I put this conglomeration of Lego bricks together, and I come upstairs beaming, and I say, look, Bethany, it's you! I thought I had two eyes, this makes me think of you. This reminds me of you. She might, if she's very spiritual and denying herself, she might be able to say, that's nice, dear. But so then what happens if I, start carrying it around with me? And we sit down for dinner and I set it down on the table. And I'm like, hey, Bethany, and instead of looking at her, I look at the Legos. And I say, hey, honey, let's go out to eat. And we're going to go on a date. And I take the Lego with me. And I'm checking in the restaurant, like, party of three, please. Can we get a booster seat for my Lego wife? But honey, it's you. I think so much of you that And pretty soon, I'm sitting there having a conversation with the Legos, and she's all by herself. And pretty soon, I'm going to be by myself, too. She doesn't want me. But I might say, well, I like doing it this way because, you know, sometimes you got to teach the students and stuff, and I can just keep you in my office this way. You're always with me. It's just, it's easier for me if I always have, you know, this with me. It may be more appealing to me. It may be more convenient for me, but it's insulting to her. I think we would agree. But don't we do that to God?
Yes.
And God says, this is who I am. Worship me. We're like, yeah, but I think God's kind of like this. Do you know how, that's one of the worst ways to start any sentence. I think God is like. What you think doesn't matter. Who he is what matters. He's told us in his word, end of discussion. But our culture is full of a bunch of people who just want to think, well, I kind of think God is like this, or I think it's going to be like this, or I think, it doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter what kind of Lego I build, that's my life. It doesn't matter what kind of idol you construct. God is who he is. And he says, I want you to worship me for who I am, not for who you conceive of me to be, not for whom you want me to be. Don't raise your hand, but have you heard somebody say something like this? Well, I know the Bible says, but I don't think God really expects this because he wants me to be happy. That is very poor theology. And frankly, a lot of us think that way, even if we don't use those words. Yeah, yeah, I know I probably shouldn't, but it would just be really hard. That would be inconvenient. That would be expensive. Do you know how much trouble that would cause if I actually did what God actually says in his word? He must have meant something else. And when you start thinking that way, he must have meant something else. He surely wouldn't expect. Or I don't. No! You are just like somebody who's using a dead statue to pray. You have created or constructed a God that does not exist. And you are worshiping him incorrectly. God says, love me as I am. Listen, it's never a good idea for a man and a woman to get married with the idea of, I'm going to change you. It's not the way you ought to do it. Now, in any marriage, you are going to change each other. You're going to rub off on each other. You're going to influence each other. But you should not marry a person for the person you want to turn them into. It's a bad idea. And what if, you know, the ceremony's over, the pictures are all done, and you're like, oh, honey, this is the happiest day of my life. I'm so glad to marry her, because now I can help you become even better. She's like, wait, did we sign that thing yet? There's nothing that you can say. I love you as you are. You know, you would be beautiful if you just had that one, just a little different, you know, if your hair were, that would be, you'd be amazing. I don't fly. And how many times do we say, oh, God, I worship you because you do things this way, and it's not the way he does things. It's the way you wish he did things. Sometimes our refusal to worship God as he is questioning him. God, why did you do that? It's not fair. Why did you take her? Why did you let this happen? How come he got the promotion? God, what are you doing? God, I'm trying to serve you, and here this tool broke, and it's going to waste all this time. And God, what are you? What? God, I'm trying to bring my children right, and now this happened, and you know we're investing and we're sacrificing to do this so that they can love you more, and now we've got this bill to pay because this appliance broke. God, come on! Isn't that attacking God as he is? And wanting to convert him into a God that just, like, is your fairy godmother? When we question God, when we say, oh, he doesn't expect me to do that, he just wants me to be happy, we are trying to love God for the imaginary figure that we want him to be. God says, don't make any graven images. You worship me as I am. If we can grab that and say, nothing has my allegiance more than God. I don't love myself more than him. I don't love anything more than him. He is my everything. And if we can say, I want to know him as he is so I can worship him for who he is, we're a long way towards loving God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. I want to close with an illustration that I read. I'm reading a book on worship that has a really powerful picture of loving God and worshiping him. And if you'll concentrate, I'm just going to read it to you. The author says, I watched in wonder as my son held his first grandchild. Looking into his eyes, Lincoln, just 2 weeks old, stared into my son's eyes intently. There they were, my 53-year-old son and my newborn great-grandson, with their eyes locked on each other. Neither was interested in anything else going on around them. No words in my vocabulary can adequately describe that scene. There was love, admiration, fascination, astonishment, curiosity, and some awe. If you have children, grandchildren, or great-grandchildren, you may have similar images in your own mind. God gave us these precious gifts for our enjoyment and maybe for our learning. In the aforementioned moment, my son's eyes exuded over an overwhelming, unconditional love. It was a love that little Lincoln could in no way comprehend. This full-grown man was so much larger, stronger, and wiser than Lincoln. Nevertheless, there was something being transferred back and forth between the two that neither could fully understand. There was something, no matter how minuscule it may have been, in Lincoln's mind, and his gaze into my son's face was captivating. That interaction reminds me of worship between God and his children. True worship is a time when the all-knowing and the begotten come together. Think about this. There is nothing material that that little baby is going to need to give to his grandfather. And yet the grandfather wants something really bad from that little baby, doesn't he? Yeah. Just his love. Have you ever given serious thought to how much your love and worship to God means to him? He's self-existent and self-sufficient. He doesn't need anything that you can give him. But he does want you to gaze into his face in wonder, amazement, love, and awe. God says, love me. Don't have any other gods. I want your exclusive affection. And don't try to change me into something else. Love me for who I am.
Isn't that just like the Lord? So very much like Jesus.
Thank you for joining us today. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is graceglory7@juno.com. graceglory7@juno.com. Pastor David M. Atkinson also has a ministry on Facebook and invites you to connect with him there. Now, until the next time, remember to walk softly with the Lord.